Tonight we've got Ginger, who's lived with type 1 diabetes since 1999, along with celiac, fibromyalgia, I'm going to say that wrong, and hypothyroidism. My goodness, I need to put my teeth in tonight. Ginger is the Associate Director of Communications of T1D Exchange, which works to improve the care and quality of life for people living with type 1 diabetes through research. Ginger is a passionate writer who has a knack for making complex health information understandable and accessible. She has written many articles, and her books are staples within the community, covering a wide range of subjects from burnout to pregnancy with type 1. Ginger loves to exercise, and her most recent book, published early this year, aims to demystify the science around exercise and type 1. So I hope I've got that all right, Ginger.
And, sounds good.
Welcome to the chat.
Thank you. Happy Monday, everybody.
Yes. Happy lunchtime-ish for you, or middle of the afternoon, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
See you there, so you hope we're okay. Well, we normally start the chat with a round that we call 90 seconds questions, but it always lasts longer than 90 seconds. But it's a bit of a quick fire just to get to know a bit more about you, if that's okay.
I'm ready.
Right. What would you say your occupation was?
I write, and I am a content machine. That's my occupation.
Oh, that's good. How old were you when you were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes?
I actually diagnosed myself at a seventh grade health fair, or actually the week before the health fair, when I was 13. My classmate was doing his project on diabetes. I had all the symptoms on his poster. And I said to my mom, I think I have diabetes. She said, no, only old people get that, which we all know is not true. Mm-hmm. And a week later, I started crying. She took me to the doctor. It was quite obvious going forward from there.
Oh, my goodness. Now, that is a new one.
Yeah. The health fair is very proud of themselves.
I was just going to say, that was a successful health fair.
Yeah. No kidding.
And definitely raised awareness.
Yeah.
Do you finger prick or use smart technology sensors?
I use a Freestyle 14-day sensor, so it's not even actually continuous. I scan anytime I want my blood sugar, and I've used the fancier CGMs, but I actually choose this today because alarms give me anxiety and arrows give me anxiety, and I just had enough of them during my pregnancies, and I just realized I needed a middle ground, so I scan a lot.
And I think that's it, isn't it? It's just finding what suits you.
Yeah, and maybe someday I'll try, you know, being alerted at all the time again, but not today.
Oh, I use Dexcom, but I have to be honest, I only have alarms on that I know I need to react to at that point. Do you know what I mean? Sort of the, if I get there, I really should know about it.
Right, yes.
And just look the rest. When you did finger prick, because I'm assuming you did at some point, did you change your lancet every time?
No, almost never.
We always joke, it's amazing they give you a one box lifetime supply at diabetes.
Yeah, that's so nice of them. They don't give us a lifetime supply of anything else.
Exactly, but we'll all have some lancets left at the end. Yeah. Do you use an insulin pump or pens, and which do you prefer and why?
I've used pump for many years in the first half of my diabetes life, but today I use mostly Afrezza, and then Afrezza is inhaled insulin for those not familiar with it, and then a long acting for my basal, and then I take a tiny amount of Novolog every day for things that Afrezza wouldn't be a good fit for.
We will be chatting about that a little later, because I'm really interested in that, and I'm sure other people will be, in the inhalable insulin. What's your go-to hypo treatment?
I like treating lows with things I can very specifically count, like 5 gummy lifesavers or 5 Sour Patch Kids, because I learned during pregnancy how to not over-treat lows. And so having that, like, I know if I drink juice, I'm going to drink the whole bottle of juice. I can't use that. So I like things that I can really identify. 5 jelly beans. So that's what I keep kind of tucked in every nook and cranny.
Yeah, that's like cartons of juice, isn't it? Even if you think you're drinking half a carton, you can't see it.
Right. It doesn't feel like it, right? It only feels good if you drink 7 gallons of it. So,
Which do you think is worse, feeling hypo or hyper?
Hypo feels physically worse. Hyper feels emotionally worse.
Okay.
And by emotionally, I mean the guilt. I do get irritated when I'm hyper sometimes, but the guilt I feel is probably.
Oh,
yeah.
Nobody does it on purpose, Ginger. Nobody.
I know. I get it. But it still happens, right?
I feel like I'm preaching to the converted now.
Yeah. But even if I understand the rationale behind that, I shouldn't feel guilty. I still do. I feel like, I'm hurting my eyeballs right now. I got to get this down.
That's it. What's one thing you like around having diabetes? Because I don't think anybody likes having diabetes.
I think having type 1 teaches you immense resilience if you let it. We endure so much on a daily basis on top of regular life, and we just power on. And there are hours in the day where our body's trying to kill us blatantly. I mean, our body's always trying to kill us, actually. So
yeah,
if you can embrace that, you can't change that type 1 has happened to you, and you stop feeling sorry for yourself, the next step is building resilience and then being aware of damn, I'm resilient because of this disease.
I'm right there with you on that one. And what's one thing that's a negative about having diabetes for you, or you don't like?
I mean, I think it really consumes your life, right? Kind of puts you on edge all day. It gives you an anxiety that you probably wouldn't have otherwise. I mean, everybody, you can have anxiety as a non-diabetic, obviously, but it gives you this level of just if I want to go for a walk at 1 p.m. with my dog, I need to plan for that beforehand. Most people don't have to do that. They don't have to plan how to stay alive for a 30-minute dog walk.
Like playing Jeopardy the whole day.
Right. Yeah. That's just, it's a level of constant anxiety that we endure that we're not even aware of sometimes because we don't have a choice and we've been doing it so long.
That's right. And the final 90-second question, if you were on a desert island and you could take 3 things with you, what would you take? All your diabetes kit of whatever type you want and your insulin and whatever other medication you already have, so you don't have to worry about that.
I would take a lot of, there's this protein type chocolate bar at Costco right now that's gluten-free and it also has pretzels and dark chocolate in it. It's so good. I would take a whole lot of those, and then my children and my husband.
Oh, if you're going that way, you could have said, I'll take my family and my house.
Right. And Costco, right? My family, my house, and Costco.
If I could take my street.
I guess if you want non-children and husband answers, oh, man, something really cozy to wrap myself up in. And I don't know. Some really good movies. I don't like being in total silence. I play movies in the background all day while I work. So I would really miss that on a desert island.
Oh, I'm like that. I have the radio on or something on the whole time.
Yeah.
I can't. I'm a definite headphones whilst working type of person. Now, I'll just check. Mary, are you around or are you still busy?
I'm here. I'm good. I'm here. I've been running around like a headless chicken.
You want me to do this next bit?
No, I'm okay. I've got a sensor on him. Just to clarify, Ginger, I'm sorry. It's been one of those diabetes nights.
I heard you were changing your son's pod, right?
It's not even that. So he was an Omnipod. He is an Omnipod 5 with Dexcom G6. G6 isn't connecting, so now I'm building a DIY one again because it needs updated and put them on that. But in the meantime, I've got them on Omnipod Eros and a Libre. I've just managed to get those set up like and settings put on the pump, and we just had a bit of a kerfuffle of which Libra app to put on the phone to start it, whether I could get it to connect to DIY. I'm not sure if I put the right one on, like, but we'll maybe use Jugluco or something later on tonight. It's a scratch head rub tummy kind of moment, and I'm not sure if I'm doing them in the right rotation. But it's okay. We're all right. Like, nobody, like, we've got like backups, and I think once I get a sensor that I can scan them, at least I'll sleep, and rather than having to finger prick them. And I think he's got no. Yeah, we're okay. We're winning. But what
you're describing right now is all the anxiety and resilience that I was just talking about. And it's
totally
like, what you're trying to do right now is keep your son alive for the next day. Let's not like sugarcoat this. That is literally what you're trying to do.
It is, but then you know, tonight passes, Ginger. Like it's all right. Like it's only in this moment where it does feel like I'm trying to keep him alive and get a night's sleep. and manage those things, and then once everything goes again, it's fine. It's just in this moment things are a wee bit hairy.
Yeah.
Oh well, but I missed the part about your diagnosis, and I know from stuff I've read before, like that your diagnosis, like you kind of picked it up yourself as a child, didn't you? And
yeah.
Like, so the bit I'm going to talk with you about is more about your diabetes and your type 1, and like the guys heard about your diagnosis. I understand that, but I'm just trying to like maybe ask a little bit more about it, about like were there any moments about it that stand out? I'm thinking like as a parent, like, what do you remember about your diagnosis? Like going back?
About 5 days in the hospital after my diagnosis to get my blood sugars down, you know, and get my body to stop dying. And, you know, that's what we're doing. And I remember at one point really crying. Nobody was in the room. My family was not in the hospital at the moment. And I just was feeling really sorry for myself and crying. And it dawned on me while I was crying that every one of my friends had something really significant that had happened to them. I had a friend who'd had a brain tumor removed when he was a toddler. I had a friend with hemophilia, a friend who had died from leukemia, a friend who had lost her father to mental illness, a friend whose mother was literally fighting a brain tumor at that moment. You know, like I have friends, nobody got it easy is what I realized. And it's like, all right, it looks like nobody gets it easy. Here's some of my not so easy. And I left the hospital not feeling sorry for myself. And I can only imagine how much your heart breaks when your child is diagnosed with type 1. I have 2 children. I hope the day never comes, right? I've screened them both twice for autoantibodies. But one thing I would really encourage parents is don't pity your child, because they're going to soak that up and they're going to pity themselves, and nothing gets in the way of thriving with type 1 diabetes more than pity.
You're
feeling sorry for yourself, you're not looking for solutions. You're not looking for strategies. You're just mad, and you're mad that this has happened to you. And that's where it just stops.
And you've got expectation.
Yeah.
That when it has to come from yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're stuck on life is unfair and this shouldn't have happened to me, you don't get to, there's nowhere after that. Like it just blocks you from thriving.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. You don't engage in that. What can I do for myself? Like what I'm feeling tonight.
Yeah. What can I do for myself? Right.
Exactly.
Right. Life is not easy for anybody. And part of your not easy is type 1 diabetes. Accept it and power through.
Exactly, exactly. Did you know anybody else who had type 1 around you?
I did not, no. Not a single one. Like,
and your parents didn't know anybody? And it was, wow, okay, yeah. So, when I was diagnosed, I had my first cousin. And there's lots of diabetes in our family, so we're a wee bit different here.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. We've got to talk about Afreeza, because like I'm sure there's loads of people on here who want to hear about Afrisa, actually. And we don't have it here. And it's a really unique way of getting insulin, not even just that it's inhalable, but how you go about choosing what to give yourself. And all, can you talk a little bit?
Talk a little bit about Afrisa. I resisted even trying it for the same reason a lot of people still resist trying it, is because the dosing is so different. So Afrisa is, for people who have no familiarity with it, you put these little cartridges of powdered insulin into this really plastic, simple inhaler thing. Like, I got 20 of them. They send you tons. You can tell there's no value in this inhaler thing. It's not a fancy gadget, and it's teeny. I could hide it in my hand. That's how small it is. And you hold it to your mouth and you just go, and that's your dose. And so there's four unit doses, 8 unit doses, and 12 unit doses. And the moment a type 1 hears that, they think, well, I can't manage diabetes that way. And I want to tell you that I'm very sensitive to insulin, right? So if I can make it work, it really can work for anybody. But you learn a completely different dosing. So I don't think of them as 4, 8, and 12. And I don't even have the 12s. I think of them as small and medium. And then if I eat a large meal, I take more than one medium. And if I eat a meal that is digesting slowly, like even a salad that might be low carb, but it has a lot of fat or protein on it, and there's still, you know, some carbs from the veggies, I'll take a 4. And I would normally, if I was taking Novolog for that salad, I would take like maybe 1 unit or less for that salad. A 4, technically, you know, the makers of Afrisa, I want to say it translates to about 2 units of insulin. It's so different that you really can't convert it. They offer that conversion to help you get a sense of where to start. But anybody that uses Afrisa will tell you, like, that's not, they have to figure out for themselves over the first few months how to dose their Afrisa. So Afrisa is in and out of your system really quick. It is the fastest insulin. It starts working within about 2.5 minutes, and you can see it noticeably turning a high blood sugar around within 15 minutes of taking a dose. So yeah, it's really fast, which I love about it. You don't have to pre-bolus. You know, you can dose when you eat. In some cases, I dose after I eat, depending on how slow that meal might digest.
I get you.
And then the really cool thing, though, is that it's out. The smallest dose is out after about an hour. The larger doses is more like 2 hours for big impact and a teeny bit of a tail in the third hour, but not really for most people.
And so there's no stacking.
You don't have to worry about, like, let's say I ate lunch at noon. If I want to walk my dog at 1, I don't have to worry about a whole bunch of insulin on board. And I can then take, if I know I ate like this really slow digesting meal, I know I can take a teeny dose of Afrisa while I'm walking my dog, and it's just going to help. But I know I don't have this wall up of Novolog on board. You know what I mean?
And I'm just thinking, like, is it, with the bigger doses, after the 2 hours, like we'll have like our insulin that will last like 6, 8 hours long, right? And so if the end of it is dying after 2 hours, if you've taken a little bit more, it's dead.
Right. And there's a drawback to that. Like, let's say I ate pizza. I need insulin in my system for more than 2 hours.
Oh, talk about that. Right? Yeah.
So there's a few things. If you're not going to bed, because I wouldn't eat pizza in the middle of the day. I don't like to eat like heavy stuff in the middle of the day. So I'm eating it pretty close to like bedtime, and I'm a big fan of intermittent fasting. So I eat my largest meal around between 7 and 10 o'clock, followed by dessert also. So I'm going to take some Afrisa, and then I'm going to take some Afrisa again before bed. And if I eat pizza, like a mega slow digesting, I might take 1 unit of Novolog to carry me through the rest of that digestion.
Cool.
Yeah.
So how much injected insulin do you take maybe on average a day then outside of Afrisa?
To give you context, if you're thinking about your basal, so I take 10 units of basal insulin a day, long acting, and then I take probably 2 units a day of injected, and one of those units might be at bedtime. One of those units might be at bedtime, and then the other is in the morning because I fast. My blood sugar usually starts to rise around 8 or 9 a.m. So I take a unit to deal with that.
Nice one.
Can I just say, Mary?
Yeah.
Can
I just absolutely.
Ginger, just from what you were saying earlier. So I appreciate what you're saying, that the units of old Fraser don't directly translate to units of insulin. But do you find that the doses of old Fraser you take are consistent? Just because it's inhaled, I'm just wondering if the dosing's different because the mechanism of absorption might not be as consistent.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a totally different game.
Okay. Right. Oh, no, that's interesting. I was just wondering because I always, I know a friend of mine who's a doctor, and when I was first diagnosed, because I was an adult, they said I had type 2, and then they put me straight on insulin. But they said, oh, that's better, because with insulin, you know exactly how much has gone into your system, whereas with tablets and things, it's, you know, the absorption and what else is in your stomach. And I was just wondering if that played into it at all with L. Fraser.
It's going into your lungs, and that's why it works so quickly. Yeah, it's because of that lung absorption. So
and it is quite consistent. Nope, that's me. I'm butting out. Sorry, Mary.
Pepper, hold on. Before you go, did you ask? I was just checking Johnny there for 2 seconds. I'm literally dodging stuff falling out of the sky here. But did you ask Ginger, if a Fraser is used for people who have type 2 diabetes too?
Wondering how common in the States, because we haven't got it here, obviously nobody uses it, but how common is the use of it in sort of
it's life? Not honestly, I don't think it's that common yet in type 1 because people assume it won't work for them, and then it was originally marketed to type 2s for mealtime.
And is it quite popular with people with type 2, do you know? Or
I don't know, because I have no real connection to that. Like, I do inhaled insulin. There's a really great inhaled insulin group on Facebook where you can just kind of watch the conversations and see how people use it. And like, there's a guy on there who eats a carnivore diet. He eats really nothing but meat, and he uses Afrezza. And you are more sensitive to Afrezza during the first like month that you use it than you will be going forward. So at first I thought like, man, I'll never use an 8. I only need 4s. And I'd learned from someone in that group how to like make my own 2s, right? By cracking open a 4 and splitting it. I don't do that anymore. I don't even bother anymore because
We're not only resilient, we're very adaptive as
we
well.
We are, right? We're very clever. We're very clever.
This is so funny.
Yeah. And a lot of people still do that in that group. And to like, so if I needed to take a teeny correction for, let's say my blood sugar was 150, I don't have my calculator handy, but I just wanted to drop it by like 30 points, I wouldn't take an Afrezza for that unless I knew I had a little bit of food still digesting. So that's when I might take a half unit of Novolog instead.
So you can't not fully inhale.
No.
A dose. Do you know, like, because the way you describe inhaling, I'm just wondering, or could you just do a small inhale and it'd roughly be half?
I think you can't. I don't think there's any way you can control what you got, you know?
Okay.
Yeah, because it's such a tiny amount of powder. You don't feel it going in. It has no taste. Sometimes when I exhale after taking a dose, a little, like, white, tiny white cloud comes out and it looks like I'm smoking, but... so that's funny.
It sounds so interesting because since me and Mary and Ginger had a little chat before here just to introduce ourselves and that, and afterwards I went and was reading your articles on it, and I was just reading it and thinking, oh, it's the sort of thing, do you know, like I'd like to play with. Well, play isn't the right word, but do you know what I mean? Just to see.
Yeah.
The thought of it, I think it's the fact that it leaves your body so fast.
Yeah. It's amazing for that. Like, I don't worry about going low in the middle of the night the way I used to, because I just know I had a Afrezza on board and it's out, you know? So it definitely helps.
And like on that plane thing, like, how did you move from, because you mentioned that you used to use an insulin pump before, is that right?
That was quite a ways ago. I haven't used an insulin pump since I was like 22. So I've tried one during pregnancy, and I hate having pumps in my skin. I hate how they can fail at a moment's notice. Like, you know, like Mary,
like tonight.
Yeah. I hate all of that. And I can achieve what I need to achieve for my personal goals with injections. And I'm willing to take, you know, injections or inhalations. I'm willing to play that game, right? There's no perfect system. Each system of taking insulin is a lot of work, and you just have to decide which workload that is more tolerable for you.
Yeah, I know. And you know what? I think as well, it's about access to choice. It's access to the choice that you think you might need, and you might not actually like it or suit that particular one or whatever. But if you don't have access to it, you're just going to get your spines fired up. And whereas if you've access to everything, or I'm not even putting those words into your mouth, actually, Ginger, because you may not have access to everything. But I think it's like when you don't have access to it, there's a...
Yeah. And, you know, on that note, I mean, Mankind is a very small pharma company. It costs a lot of money to get a new drug. It's, you know, it's a one of a kind. There's nothing else on the market. So it costs them even more money to introduce and get approval in each country. So that's why you don't have it yet, but I guarantee they're working on it. And you can go to the Mankind pipeline and see what country. I think Australia and India was what they were last trying to get approval for. Oh. They're trying. It's not that they don't care about you. It's that it costs a bajillion dollars to get it through the process. Because introducing a new injectable insulin, it's not the first of its kind, right? So it's not as big of a deal. And this, they have to demonstrate the safety for your lungs, and they have to demonstrate the dosing. And it's all new, so it takes more work to get it approved.
Of course. And how does it fare price-wise then? Like, so, like on the route map, it has India, and like, that must indicate that it's cheaper.
I'm not good at comparison, but I can tell you that my copay with my American health insurance through my employer, my Afrezza costs, a month's worth of my Afrezza costs the same as a month's worth of my Novolog. So it's comparable.
Comparable. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Then you see, that's good.
Yeah.
Like, okay.
And also, can I ask, because they're going obviously to warmer countries, like Australia is not known for cold summers in most of it. I know there are cooler parts, and India, is it more tolerant to extremes of temperature because it's a powder?
Well, there's what the FDA says about that, which in the Mankind will tell you, you need to monitor the temperature. I can tell you, I did an experiment once I left a cartridge in my car on purpose in the summer because it's just one cartridge. It didn't feel like I was losing a lot. And I used it like 3 weeks later, and it still worked. So that's not me giving anyone advice to neglect their insulin temperature, but I think it's a more resilient.
Because it doesn't need refrigerating, does it?
You should store it in the fridge.
I didn't realize that.
Interesting. Yeah,
and it actually takes up quite a bit of space. One of my complaints about Afrezza is the packaging. It's just very... it takes up a lot of space. And so I have this, like, it looks like a pencil kit that you would take to school. I think it is a pencil kit. Like, I got it on Amazon. And I keep as much as I can fit in there so that I know I could just head out the door with this. Or I keep a little bit in my purse, too. And then when I need more, I pull it out of the fridge.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I hadn't realized that. I had thought that it would be you'd keep it at ambient temperature, which I was thinking, oh, that'd be really cool for developing countries anyway.
Yeah.
Because obviously keeping things cool is expensive and for some people not attainable.
Yeah.
But I suppose these things are evolving.
Yeah. Okay. That's great.
Well, okay.
We've got there, so... If you're all right with Claire, if you want to run off or do whatever, just shout and I will carry on.
I'll carry on. You carry on there this bit, then I'll just go in and check and see how things all got started.
No problem. That's why we have two people, Ginger. Not that this happens every time. I'm wondering now if we can just move onto another subject, because I know that you've written some amazing books, and also, if anybody's interested, lots of really helpful articles that, as I said in the introduction, are really understandable. And when I say that, I don't mean they're simplistic, they're just right. Understandable.
Right. I love teaching the complicated stuff that we all need and deserve to know, and we're not being taught at the doctor's office. But yeah. I really like teaching it and writing about it in a way that is really easy to digest. I do not like fancy writing. You won't find any of that from me.
But it is, I've sort of obviously in preparation for this, I've read a few of your articles, and you sort of read it, think, oh, da, da, da. And then when you think back, I think, oh, that's covered a lot of stuff. And oh, no, that was fine. So I'm wondering, one of your books that I know a lot of people may already know about or not, depending what they are, was dealing with burnout, diabetes burnout.
Mm, yeah.
And how to deal with it. So I'm wondering if we could just do a little section on that, because I think, I know I've said this before, is I have a feeling when people are diagnosed, you're told about, oh, you've got to get your eyes checked because it can affect your eyes, and you've got to be careful of your kidneys and your feet and this and that and the other. But I've never heard anybody actually be told, and also of your mental health, and that you are likely to have burnout at some point, and these are the symptoms. And yeah. If you start feeling that, come back, because we can talk about it. And it's not ever, just prepare people and let them know that everybody goes through it.
Yeah, normalize it, right?
Because exactly.
It would be
exactly.
Totally nuts to not get sick and tired of managing something 24/7, right? I mean, something that interrupts your sleep, your birthday, like tries to threaten your life on an hour-by-hour basis. How would you not get tired of protecting yourself all day long? Like, that's what you're doing, is you're constantly protecting yourself from type 1 diabetes. And even Britney Spears' bodyguards get a day off, right?
Yeah.
So, like, we don't get any days off. So you need to give yourself credit for that. And I think by anticipating burnout and expecting it, then you remove the shame from it. But also, you can consciously like give yourself a day to back off just a little bit and like, all right, my blood sugar went high after lunch. I'm not going to beat myself up for this. Mm. This is a lot of work and it's every day. And I'm just going to take a deep breath and do the best I can.
I think that's it. So just as a sort of starter, how would you describe burnout, or what is burnout? And I know we've sort of just said it's a reaction to the life we live, really, and all the things, but some of the symptoms or things that people might notice.
Yeah, and that's important too. I think it's important to define it, because a lot of people assume burnout is only legit if you stop taking your insulin or you stop checking your blood sugar. Yeah. You can feel burnt out and still be doing all the things you're supposed to do. And that's a legit version of burnout. And there's no shame in that. And you can say, I am burnt out, but I'm going to keep doing what I do every day.
Mm.
So I think obviously there's a range, and the more severe version of burnout, where you should definitely reach out to someone for help and support, is if you start skipping your insulin and you're really ignoring your diabetes for days on end, right? And you're putting your life in danger. And that would probably coincide with a depression diagnosis, which I think is different than burnout. And so if that is what you're experiencing, like, it's definitely find a moment to ask somebody you trust for help, or tell them what's going on, because your life is in danger, right? Yeah. Then there's that middle ground of burnout, where you're kind of like, maybe you've stopped counting carbs and you're just winging it with your insulin. Your blood sugars are all over the place and you're exhausted, but you don't want to care. And you're just doing the bare minimum to stay alive and stay out of the hospital. But, you know, you're also feeling really lousy about it. And there's a place to go from there. Like, it doesn't have to be perfect. And I think we all get stuck in thinking that the opposite of burnt out is perfect, right?
Yeah.
But you could just start taking your insulin a little more often, checking your blood sugar once a day instead of zero times a day. Or, you know, just trying to count your carbs and dose carefully at breakfast and lunch, but maybe you wing it at dinner. Maybe that gives you that sense of freedom from this thing that's burnt you out. Like, find that comfortable middle ground that helps relieve the pressure for you.
And I think also, just from personal experience, I say also, I expand what I accept as normal. If I'm not feeling like that at a certain level, I'd be like, oh, I need to correct now. I need to do something. But it's just like, have that number in my head, and it is a number, and it will depend how I feel. I will set it that I might do something before that number.
Right. But
if I don't, it's not going to kill me. It's just like, for this time, I just don't want it. I don't want to ignore. I'll do what I have to do.
Yeah. And that acknowledges
that's okay.
Yeah. And that is part of how you could curb burnout and prevent it, by giving yourself flexibility, right? When other non-diabetes parts of your life are really stressful, or for no reason at all, like maybe you just need a break from expecting your target range to be this. Like right now, I'd say my target range is broader than I've ever let it be. And it's still, you know, my A1C is still exactly where it was before, but I'm not looking at a graph that's showing me this tight expectation, even though I'm still staying in that. I've lightened up the pressure on just the graph, right? By raising my high target. And again, like my A1C hasn't changed, but I've lightened the pressure on myself.
And this is from my point, and I know you sort of know more, even if my A1C went up a bit for a while, actually that's better for me than the alternative. Because like you say, if you carry on, where can it lead? Whereas at least here you're giving yourself a bit of space.
Yeah, like there's a lot of people talk about, and I talk about in the book too, taking an intentional diabetes vacation. And that doesn't mean throwing your insulin out the window, right? And threatening your life. It means like, okay, for 1 month, I'm going to like raise my target range. I'm going to eat more carbs than I usually let myself eat. Or I'm going to eat X without feeling like a bad diabetic, whatever kind of messages you've been playing in your head a lot that are increasing that pressure on you. Purposely saying, here's a period of time that I'm going to take a little diabetes vacation and see how I feel at the end of it. And maybe you recharge, or maybe you find out you need another month.
And I don't know if you know Rose Stewart, who's a psychologist over here. She's in Wales, but very well known in the UK. And I do like, and this is one of the things that I actually take note of, and when I say about changing my targets, is she actually said, plan ahead when you're not burnt out of what's acceptable rules for when you are. So you're not in a bad place and having to decide what you're going to do. You always have a plan for a bad day.
Yes.
And maybe even have a plan of who you're going to chat to.
Right. Yeah, that's a great idea. And so also, what you're highlighting too, the whole thing comes down to being really kind to yourself, right?
Yeah.
And giving yourself flexibility to struggle sometimes, or have less energy for diabetes, or not be able to meet your same standard every day. And just being like, this is really hard. It's okay if I don't do this as well today as I did it yesterday.
And if you've got through if you've not managed to sort of stop it like that and things are slipping, I know years ago I got down that I just wasn't testing that much at all. I just got out of the habit because I got tired of it basically, for whatever reason. And I know the one phrase, and I use it a lot with people, is how do you eat an elephant one spoon at a time? Do you know what I mean? It's just like you say, thinking, okay, I can't face testing 8 times a day.
Right.
But first thing in the morning, I'll test my blood sugar and see how that goes. And do you know what I mean? Once I got used to that, then I might introduce another one. But
yeah,
sort of just be gradual, that you can't go from zero to full steam ahead.
Right.
Would you agree with that?
Yes, you don't need to. And we have this idea in our heads that Joe and Jill over there are doing it perfectly. They're not.
Yeah.
And there are people out there who eat hardcore restrictive diets, that is really, that comes down to a personality thing. That if you can do that, that is because you have an extremely type A personality. But I'd also, I wish I could keep a chart of how many people eat that way for years and years. There's people that get into it for a few years and then, you know, it's not an easy thing to sustain. And nor is it always healthy. Like just because your blood, just because an extreme diet makes your blood sugars perfect, for example, doesn't mean it's actually healthy for you, right? So it's just, nothing's black and white is the point.
Yeah.
And like everybody has to put in the work and nobody's doing it perfectly.
And I think that's it. You never know what other people's lives are like.
Right.
You only see what they show you.
Right.
A bit like looking at Facebook.
Right.
You know, everybody looks like they've got a perfect life.
Yes.
I don't think so. Indeed.
Right.
So you've sort of said if people start feeling burnt out to sort of back off, be kind to themselves, sort of widen targets, accept that you're doing a lot and should really be patting yourself on the back for even getting up in the morning and starting your day.
Yeah.
What sort of things do you feel maybe are the things that you think or use that help could help somebody day to day that might help prevent burnout coming on as much? Do you know what I mean? Before it actually sets in, are there strategies you use for
I
that?
Mean, I really think you need to check in on the messages you keep telling yourselves. I know we touched on this a little already, but I want to emphasize it. If you have a constant stream in your head of I suck at this, you're going to always struggle. I have high blood sugars too. I don't tell myself I suck at diabetes. I tell myself this is really hard. I'm annoyed that my blood sugar is high. I do feel that moment of guilt, but I don't beat myself up for it. I don't tell myself that I suck at managing diabetes just because my blood sugar is high. Right? So really go check in and be honest with yourself, because this probably applies to every part of your life. If you're doing this in your diabetes, you're probably doing it in many parts of your life. It is a habit, and it's a habit you can change, and you can change it with Post-it notes. You start putting positive messages all around you and reaching for them. The moment you start wanting to reach for your usual negative messages, you'll change your life. You'll change how you talk to yourself. You'll change how you see the world, how you see a challenge. You have to choose and acknowledge, though, that it's a habit and a choice. How you think is a choice. And that applies to diabetes, but it applies to every part of your life. I could choose every day to be pissed off and annoyed because of X, Y, Z. I don't. Yeah. I choose to enjoy everything that comes through the day. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying I'm idiotically happy. Of course, I get mad and frustrated. But look at what your core beliefs and your core messaging is to yourself every day.
And I bring it back to me all the time. Sorry, I'm just talking about me, Ginger. but I think with me, one of the things is it's not me who's failing and being bad. It's the type one that is misbehaving.
Right.
And I'm just trying to corral it in.
Yes. And you know, another thing that, something I'm really passionate about teaching ever since I learned it, like last year and this year is really when I've learned it the most, is that there's actually 6 hormones in a person with type 1 diabetes that don't function correctly. We have only been given 1.
Yeah.
Right. So, and if you type in to Google 6 dysfunctional hormones of type 1 diabetes, you'll find an article at T1D Exchange that explains all of those. But these hormones manage things like how much glucose your liver produces all day. So as type 1s, we're producing more sugar than we would if we didn't have type 1, which makes our daily hourly job even harder. It makes it harder to manage our appetite. It makes it harder to manage our weight, our blood sugar, the moment we wake up. So there's, you got to research all those hormones. And when you're frustrated that your blood sugar isn't cooperating, remind yourself, like, I have not been given all the tools to manage.
We're trying to manage an imperfect system.
Right. Right.
There's only so much we can do.
Yes.
And do that. So if you just had a really quick sort of 30-second, 60-second roundup, what would you sort of like people to know about burnout or what they can do? Could you do that? Or
yeah, I'd say first, it's normal, and it would be crazy if you didn't feel burnt out. I'd be worried about you if you weren't sick of managing type 1. I'd think you might be a robot. Mm-hmm. And secondly, be nicer to yourself. You don't have to do this perfectly. You can do a medium level of effort, if that's what you can sustain without breaking down, do that, right? It doesn't have to be all or nothing. It can be a little bit this month. It might be a little more next month. It might be a lot in January. And then in February, it might code down a little because you're really stressed at work. Give yourself some credit for doing this every day.
Yeah, I think that's, I always say to people, give yourself a pat on the back.
Yes.
You're doing so much more than you're giving yourself credit for just walking around. So that was really brilliant. Now, I know your most recent book is on exercise in type 1, and having sort of read and spoken to you, you are an active person, Ginger.
Yes.
And on the go. So can we just talk a little bit about exercise? I know it'll be a whistle stop tour, but it's always a handy subject. And one of the things I just like to say is exercise isn't just going to the gym or going for a run or playing football or hockey or something. Exercise is actually going to the shops or hoovering.
Yes, yes.
Because they're the things most of us struggle with on.
Yes.
Well, I'd say a daily basis, but I don't hoover on.
I mean, the biggest thing for most people, and especially if vacuuming the house causes lows. When I talk to people and they're telling me their exercise struggles, the biggest thing is that most people have too much background insulin on board.
Yeah.
And whether you're on a pump or you're on an injection, I'll tell you personally, and again, I'm not your doctor, so please talk to your doctor before making changes in your insulin doses.
Yeah.
But I have my Lantus, my long-acting dose, dialed down to as low as it can be while I'm staying in my goal, but I know I can go for a fasted walk, which just means I don't have food or rapid-acting insulin on board without my blood sugar dropping. And I know that if my blood sugar drops during a fasted walk, I have way too much basal insulin on board. In a pump, you know, and so for people on an injection of long-acting, that might be a reduction by one unit, right? If I'm on 10 units and I'm reducing my dose by one unit, that's a teeny percentage.
Yeah.
That's a teeny dose for some people, but it's a big percentage for me, depending on how much you take, right?
And so your background needs can vary, because I know I
move
a lot less in the summer to the winter.
Exactly.
At the moment, we're literally going from,
yes,
it was warm a week ago, and we're now going into it, well, not cold by Vermont standards, but cold by UK standards. So I'm all over the place at the minute, and I will be in spring.
Yes. And if you're not making adjustments in your basal insulin, like, you're going to have lows all the time for, even outside of exercise. If you're on a pump, people think, well, I set a temp basal. But if your temp basal starts when your exercise started, that's too late. And you're probably, your temp basal isn't dramatic enough. It's not enough of a reduction.
Yeah.
So you can absolutely exercise without going low, without eating carbs to fuel the workout, if you get your basal down, right? And that takes experimenting, and I guide you through that in the book. But that's the biggest problem for most people. And the next thing is learning how to plan your exercise. I love to exercise when I'm in a fasted state. So I exercise a lot in the morning, and I exercise again in the afternoon. And some of that's, dog walks, which are gentle, and some is more intense, like a jog or weightlifting or jumping rope. But I'm planning ahead so that I have as little rapid acting insulin on board. And so I'm actually exercising before I eat instead of after. We've all been taught really old school things at the doctor's office, like you got to eat 15 grams of carbs before you go exercise. Yeah. And then the last thing I'll say, if we have a minute, is need to learn the difference between aerobic versus anaerobic. So weightlifting is anaerobic exercise. You don't burn glucose in the same way. So if you ate 15 grams of carbs and you end up high and you're like, what happened? It's because you're doing an anaerobic workout, and your body actually produces glucose during anaerobic exercise. So that's a whole nother thing to learn how to manage, but you can do it. And none of it is crazy. People are like, oh, this doesn't make any sense. It's actually exercise science, but your body isn't doing the work for you of producing more insulin during a CrossFit workout or weightlifting, or producing less insulin and releasing glucose during a jog. So you have to figure out that science and do the work for you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I was sort of told, which I think is one of the best things that I've done at times when I've started doing new things, is literally have a piece of paper or a notebook that when you get back, just write down what you actually did.
Yes.
Because you'll start to see, because it might work one day and it doesn't work another, and then you can sort of think about it. And like you say, I am very much, I will avoid having any insulin on board, or, you know, so obviously I've got background there. But because that is such a big variable, mm-hmm. that is so difficult to predict.
And once you take all those notes and you do that fine tuning work, I mean, I exercise sometimes 2 hours in the morning if you count a long dog walk and then my cardio and weights. Without having eaten any food. And I don't worry about going low because I've done the experiments, I've taken the notes, and I know I'm in this safe place because I'm in a fasted state and my long acting is fine-tuned. And if I start going low during that, it tells me for some reason my insulin sensitivity has gone up. I probably need to lower my long acting insulin dose by 1 unit and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. And I think what you're saying is very true, because I think of exercises in 3 stages. So there's preparation, like you say, I do use a pump. So at least an hour and a half before, depending what the exercise is, I'll start lowering my basal so I've got less insulin on board. The during, yeah. because I want to be able to do what I want to do without going hypo or hyper if I can.
Right.
So I can actually do what I want to do. But then there's also the post and the after.
Yes.
Because I don't know how you find this, but I know through the experiments and things I've done, because I'm not doing a 2-hour exercise. Do you know what I mean? If I'm exercising yep. a bit, I'll have lowered my basal, which is fine during, but then obviously I've got less insulin on board after.
Yep.
And I'm no longer exercising. So I sort of, with that, and I know this, I would never advise anybody else to do it without testing and doing it, because whatever. But I sort of find sometimes I need insulin after exercising.
Yeah. And that's then really overnight, normal.
I need less. Do you know yes. what I mean? I need to compensate yep. for all the basal I've lost because yes. it's yes. kept me steady.
Right. But
if I don't do something, I'm going to rock it.
And that's one of the reasons that your blood sugar can rise after exercise is the lack of basal during. But there's yeah. other reasons too. So if you just did a lot of weightlifting, your body is, first of all, your body was converting lactic acid to glucose while you were weightlifting. Mm-hmm. But then after, if you did an intense weightlifting workout, your muscle stores of glucose are depleted. So if you don't go eat a meal and take insulin, your liver is going to release more glucose to go yeah. replenish, right? And so I used to compete in powerlifting. As soon as I was done with my training session, I would need a bolus, a whole unit of insulin, even yeah. if I didn't eat, just to manage my post-workout blood sugar. It's normal. And what stops people from figuring this out is they get mad that because they think it's illogical. But I want to encourage you, and what I teach you in that book is to see that this yeah. is actually your body being really normal, except for the whole producing insulin part.
And I think it's like you were saying, that we are deficient in more hormones than insulin, but even yeah. insulin is a trigger for other hormones that we may still produce, but we've got an imperfect system.
Right.
And you're saying our body will still carry on dumping glucose because it's not actually getting the signals that we don't need it still.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's been doing it because we have been needing it.
Yeah.
But, oh God, this person's actually moving. Unusual, but true. Do it. And it's like when that's going to switch off. And maybe in my mind, but I have my own logic here. So Ginger, unlike you, I do not know the proper science. but in my mind, it's that bit of insulin sort of triggers my liver to sort of get back into line.
Yes, exactly. Right. It's complicated, but you can, once you take some good notes and you learn what's going on and you mm-hmm. learn what type of workout you're doing, you can create the ability to enjoy exercising without crazy lows and highs, but it takes some yeah. work. Yeah.
And it's not only the preparation and things like that, it's the time of the day. There's so many factors.
Yes. But you can make any time. Like I used to exercise the most at 7 p.m. after my babies went to bed, right? When I had uh-huh. really little kids. Now I prefer to exercise as much as I can in the morning before I start my work day. You can make either work for you. I'm not telling you, you have to do it my way. You just have to learn all the variables that you can manage to make it work.
And that's where I found having a record of what I'd done, because if you, and maybe it's me and my memory, but you start, like you're saying, you used to always exercise in the morning. And now because things have changed, you're doing it in the evening. And then you go back to, oh, well, I'll do it in the morning. I used to. And every time I've forgotten what I used to do when I did it in the morning.
Right. Yeah. You got to write it down.
And if you've got a sort of notes, it's a good starting point again. Things might have changed.
Yes.
No, that's really good. And what would you say about, I know if you know that you're having planned exercise, you can, like you say, make sure you've not got insulin on board and preferably do it fasted is easier. You're taking variables. What would you say for unplanned exercise?
I mean, I never go for my jog without candy in my little my fanny pack thing, right? So I'm always prepared for a potential low, even if I think it's extremely unlikely. And so that's when things like, if you really want to, you know, my friends, can you go for a walk? And I had literally just, it was a beautiful day. She wanted to go for a really long walk. I had literally just taken so much insulin. I would have taken half as much if I knew I was about to go for a 4-mile walk. And so I just found, I wasn't hungry, but I just found the most high carb thing I could find in my fridge. I don't remember what it was, but like, you know, a banana would definitely get me through some of that. And so I ate food I didn't want so that I could enjoy a walk with my friend.
Yeah, no. And that bananas are my staple food.
Yeah.
Cause they don't hit me too fast, but they're fast enough.
Yeah.
No, that's really, really useful. So again, like with the burnout bit, could you just do a quick pricey just so that somebody's got a take home? Important things to take note of. That'd be really
I mean, if you're just getting started trying to figure this out, or if you've been having a really hard time, I would create an experiment and I would try to repeat that experiment every day. So that means if you want to jog, do this experiment every day at the same time of day and eat the same thing before or the same thing after. Or, you know, if it's you're jogging at noon, eat the same thing for breakfast so that you're not throwing in new variables of guessing food and carbs and insulin doses, right? And then learning how to actually treat lows carefully is a big thing, because if you are waking up low, but you want to exercise in the morning without insulin on board, you better not over-treat that low, right? So I'm really good at, if I wake up in a little low, I'm going to have 2 Sour Patch Kids because I know my blood sugar rises pretty easily in the morning. And then I can still go do my fasted exercise and stay in my range because I haven't overdone the treatment for the low.
Yeah.
So consistency. And in general, I would say just being consistent and exercising daily. If you exercise twice a week, you're going to have this constant change in your insulin sensitivity. If you exercise every day, you're going to have a new normal of insulin sensitivity. And you're just going to benefit from, you know, the awesomeness of exercising every day. So I would try to really adopt this as like a daily habit in order to make it simpler to manage your blood sugar.
But like you say, I think it's working out what works for you.
Yes. Take good notes.
The way you can do that is try and have as least variables as possible to start with, and then you can introduce the variables once you know what's happening. That's really good. Now, I know that we've just passed 5:30. Are you okay for a few more minutes or not?
No,
I was just wondering if I could just ask you a few questions, because I know you've written on it and we've chatted about it. Is I think we all have heard the possibilities of delaying the onset of type 1 and that there's a drug that's been approved for treatment of that, of people if they're that. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are, what you know about that, what's your involvement?
What anybody should absolutely consider doing is screening their children and family members for the autoantibodies of type 1 diabetes. And I'm not familiar with how you would do this in the UK, but
there is a trial here that you can with okay. children. I think there's an age range of children, and I'm doing this off the top of my head. And it
I'm back. I'm back. I can talk about this a little bit.
Okay.
So, yay! All right, we're like passing the baton on. We have Elsa here in the UK now, and Ginger, and it's only from 3 to 13 year olds at the minute. So it's not our like wider family like TrialNet was. I think TrialNet was up to age 40.
I have to tell you that I know people being diagnosed with type 1 in their 60s. Quite a few.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh no, we know this. And I know that speaking with the researchers here, like they're scoping wider, but it's just harder for them to predict onset of type yes. one.
Well,
from,
let's explain that science a little bit for people.
Yeah,
because what screening is doing is looking for autoantibodies, not the symptoms of type 1 diabetes, but autoantibodies, which are the result of your immune system attacking your own body. And there are some very specific autoantibodies that they can look for and measure. And those autoantibodies, research through TrialNet has found that most people have them present in their body before age 5, even if they don't actually get diagnosed with type 1 until their teens, 20s, 30s, 40s. And so they linger, right? So the attack on your immune system, you know, for example, my diabetes started long before the seventh grade, even though the seventh mm-hmm. grade is when mm-hmm. my symptoms started. It started long before that, about a decade, probably, according to this research. Right. Mm-hmm. But there's usually some kind of trigger, and there's no firm. We all have examples that we've experienced, but it's all anecdotal and research. But like my whole family had the flu. So obviously the stress on my body from the flu kind of drove that full onset. But if someone had tested my blood sugars a few years before that, they might have noticed some fluctuating abnormal blood sugar levels. But yeah. It's not anything that resulted in symptoms. So the point is, it takes years to develop. And there is, that's dog barking. There is in the US an FDA approved therapy that is proving to delay the full onset. But there's also a whole bunch of other therapies in clinical trials right now that are working to delay. But you can only delay if you identify type 1 in those earlier stages. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's why screening in our children is so important, because these things start so early.
Yes. And even if you don't have access to something that could delay, most people end up in DKA, even if their parents know all about diabetes. And they've found in research that DKA permanently damages the brain. And kids that are in really severe DKA by the time they're diagnosed have just more, their diabetes is harder to manage. Their blood sugars are more volatile even after diagnosis.
And you know what? We see that here in our house, because both Johnny and I were randomly diagnosed like really, really early. And as variable as our blood sugars are, I don't feel that they're, oh gosh, I don't even have the right word. I'm going to say that I don't feel like they're as
sensitive.
As mad.
Yeah.
Okay. And I don't like, touch wood, we've never had DKA, neither of us. I think there's actually something still protecting our lows as well. I think there's something, maybe it's just like all in my head too, but I don't feel things are as crazy.
But that
for
makes
us.
Sense based on what the research has found. So that's really cool to hear.
Yeah. And like, so with adults, so say you are a sibling of somebody who has type 1, and would you have your children tested? Or
I personally have tested my children twice, maybe three times actually, because I want to contribute to the research, first of all. So just getting your kids screened contributes to what they are learning about who develops type one and who doesn't. And it's a simple blood test. So there's blood in the States, there's intravenous where you go to the blood lab. Or there's the at-home finger test. And I don't know if you guys have the at-home.
We're at home here with a finger prick. It was a blood draw with TrialNet when we had TrialNet here. And I think maybe is TrialNet still in England? I'm thinking possibly.
Definitely a while back it stopped taking new people as far as I'm aware, if I'm remembering correctly. I couldn't tell you if they've continued with people who were already being tracked.
Because it was in the University of Bristol, I think.
I think it was withdrawn, but I don't know if that's just from new recruits. But I do know that, like you're saying, it's a finger prick test for ELSA, isn't it? And I suppose just putting I think it is also a choice for somebody because you are doing a test on like your children and whether you want that. And I know my feeling is now there's an actual treatment, I feel a lot sort of better about testing. But until there was one, I always sort of in the back of my mind had, are you medicalizing a child's life earlier? You're extending the time that they're in the system.
Yeah. But you're also keeping a closer eye on it. But also, even if there isn't one that's approved, once you test positive for autoantibodies, you or your child, you become eligible for a whole bunch of ongoing therapies that are in research, right? And so they need participants. And I know where I'm not saying use your child as a guinea pig, but if they've made it to human trials, they've determined that these things are relatively safe, right? And if I had a 4-year-old who tested positive, I would do anything I could to help delay the need for daily insulin therapy, because managing type 1 in a 4-year-old versus an 8-year-old is a wildly different experience. And you're also going to give that child 4 more years during critical stages of development, you're going to give them normal blood sugars.
I'm just putting it forward that, you know, it is a consideration for somebody. You know, sort of there are other things, and I don't know if we even know yet, and just in case you do, so if you've got somebody and you have, because I know the trials have gone on because we've got, I can't think of the name of the drug, and I know it begins with T.
Teplizumab.
Yes.
Even if I've got it written down, I can't say it. So I don't know if they know yet that if somebody has been tested, found to be developing it, have the antibodies, not developed it yet, take the drug, delay the onset. And as you say, it is a delay rather than you'll never get it. Once they have developed type 1, do they know yet if there are any benefits long term for the fact that you've prevented it, apart from obviously you've had it less time?
So there's still a lot more to learn about teplizumab and other things like it, because all they've FDA approved right now is people who test positive for autoantibodies prior to an actual diagnosis, right? But they're still testing out, well, what happens if instead of one round, because when you get teplizumab, it's like a 14-day period. You show up every day at the clinic, you sit there for 3 hours. It's 30 minutes of actually receiving the medication via intravenous, via a vein, but there's prep and setup. So you sit there for 3 hours, you go home, you come back the next day. You can go to school during this, you know, you're not being put in a bubble. But what they don't know yet, and they are studying, is what happens if we do this again next year? And what happens if we do it the year after that? Will that continue the delay? So all they can say right now is what's been FDA approved, which is that this has shown to delay the full onset of type 1 diabetes for an average of 3 years. And that's that one infusion round.
And I think it's important to say it is an infusion thing, because I know I went to a discussion on the research for this. It was before there was anything approved. And it was only when I was actually in the session and some of the healthcare people were talking, and it may be my naivety, I'd always thought it was a tablet or something people took.
Oh, yeah.
And do you know what I mean? And it is also parents, because in the UK, it will be children because they're the ones being tested.
Right.
So it's not somebody independently as an adult being tested. But I suppose it is also the consideration of, just because of financial circumstances or whatever, that it is that commitment of going for the infusions. Because I believe in the UK, I don't know if that's changing now with ELSA, there are only certain centres that actually give the treatment.
Right. I mean,
so
this
it might
is
not
brand
be a
new,
hospital
right?
down the road.
We don't have to put them up
in a different part of the country.
We don't have to put them up here in the UK, yes.
No.
It's not
I thought they had it in, was it Sheffield or somewhere?
But
like
it's
that?
Probably no. in trials. It's probably being studied, right? But it hasn't been
I don't know if it is. But
maybe it's a trial that they were doing then, and it was I think it was somewhere like Sheffield, because I know somebody brought that up, that some parents it's just not feasible.
Yeah, and that is a problem even in the States. If Tzield is Tzield is the brand name of teplizumab, if that's easier for you to say.
I'll just avoid it.
Yeah, there you go. But it's getting access to it. It's not cheap. And, you know, getting your insurance to approve it is a whole ordeal. So they are, of course, working on making this accessible. But that takes time.
I was going to ask you a question as well. Oh, yeah. No, I know what it is. Because I see Leon, like the practical diabetic here, is in the chat too. And he's over in Australia. And he has this hypothesis. And you'll kill me for saying this, Leon. Or maybe you might, maybe you won't. But see with the slower onset of type 1, like LADA. Like, I know they're trying to change that name. But mm-hmm. it's like stage 2 type 1. And like teplizumab is being given to those who have stage 2 type 1. And do you know if they're looking at its use in those cases?
The stages of type 1 are not, so the stages are based on how many types of autoantibodies you have present. It's not based mm-hmm. on, so LADA, you know, there are people that are diagnosed before they need insulin for a while, but they still have, they're still like, you know, have all the autoantibodies by the time they're diagnosed with LADA and they had high blood sugars. They're just still producing enough insulin that they don't need daily insulin therapy, and other things might help, you know?
I get you. Okay.
So it's not the same as stage all right. 2 of type 1. Yeah.
So that, okay. That makes that a bit clearer actually.
But they are studying, there's clinical trials of putting people who are just diagnosed with type 1 on Tzield, and seeing if it helps restore insulin production for a little while, or, you know, keeps their insulin needs very minimal. So that is like an ongoing, and the Harvard just published something about it, I think, saying that it does help preserve insulin production.
And they're doing similar things like with the drugs that are there for type 2, like the GLP inhibitors and things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And like that is holding off type 1, but it's not protecting the beta cell
stop the
degradation.
Right.
Yeah.
That, but it can preserve, it has been shown to preserve insulin production.
Yeah.
Another route, yeah.
This has been really interesting.
It's a really exciting area, isn't it? Because it's just at the start, and there's just so many things that you sort of feel, even though the treatment might not be because of the time it takes out, but give it another 5-10 years, and you're thinking, oh, goodness, where will we be then?
Right. Well, and that doesn't even, we haven't even talked about Vertex and stem cell therapy. That
oh, my goodness.
Has cured type 1 diabetes in people with long-term type 1 diabetes.
Yeah.
Vertex's stem cell therapy has successfully cured these people, really, if you want to call it a cure or treatment, whatever. But you know, when people complain that where's the cure? It's like, or the cure is being hidden from us. I can tell you in my position of being able to interview some of these amazing researchers,
yeah,
they will not let the cure be hidden from you. They are working on it, and decades of research has led to this. It took Doug Melton is the person from Harvard mm-hmm. who developed these stem cells, and it took him 10, 15 years just to figure out the first step because yeah. it's so complicated. So we have to be patient and we have to be hopeful.
And I think I look at some of the other autoimmune sort of diseases like the osteoarthritis and things like that. They have so much now that's come through. And
yeah.
you're sort of just thinking, you know, hopefully it'll be our turn at some point.
Yes, right. And cystic fibrosis. Vertex yeah. has actually produced an incredible, I think it's considered a cure if you catch the cystic fibrosis when the children are really, really young.
But really?
That's, you know, like it happens. We've got to be patient.
And even if I think the thing is, maybe I'm old and just that's the way I think, negative, yeah. pessimistic. But,
right.
but my thought is, if I'm honest, to say that there'll be a cure, I don't know if there will be a proper cure, but will there be something that like prevents it? Like if you've got something that right. prevents it for the whole of your life, well,
that protects you.
It's not a cure, but
yeah, I guess a cure would probably be getting my immune system to stop it, right?
Exactly.
To stop
exactly.
doing what it's doing.
Exactly.
So these treatments are working around the immune system.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. even if it just helps, and it's a bit like with the study for the medalists that have had it like for over 50 years,
mm-hmm.
and the complications that those people might have. And they found anybody who could produce even the tiniest amount of insulin still,
yeah,
it improved their chances of, you know, not having serious complications. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Wow.
So even if you could just maintain somebody being able to produce a tiny amount of insulin
yeah.
through their whole life, do you know what I mean?
Yes.
That would be so beneficial, even if they still had to take insulin and do things.
Yeah.
But if you have a healthy life.
Absolutely. If anyone's curious about the Vertex work, if you Google the title, stem cell therapy gets green light in human trials. That explains yeah. the science. I know that you've got some people in the chat who are on it with the Googling.
Yes.
So
that's great. They made a wonderful film as well. Like a movie, like a little short movie, wasn't it?
Yes.
What was it called?
It was called The Human Trial.
Yes, the human trials, like it was the human something. And it just made it very real.
Yes.
Mm. And kind of portrayed as well, like the imperfectness of it all too, with the girl it didn't work for. Isn't that right?
Yeah, man, that feels like it was about a year and a half ago.
It didn't take, but then it's still all early
that
stage.
That's not Vertex. That's a different stem cell therapy, because there's only been.
You're right. I think you're right. Yes. I'm thinking of a different thing. I am thinking of a different thing. Yeah. Reverse the horse. Edit that bit out, Tom. Only joking. He doesn't edit anything. He's just being agent.
Yeah. Well, Ginger, can I just say, because we've taken more of your time than we're going to, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been so interesting. And I know we were just picking small little bits, and there's so much more we could talk about.
Yeah, we could go on and on, I think, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. We could be here till midnight and we still yes. wouldn't be finished. But
we didn't even talk about pregnancy.
Yeah, no. I was just going to say, we haven't even touched on that. And I know your book is a bit of a go-to for a lot of people.
We'll book a date for 2024, right?
Yeah. All right. Sounds good.
And who's interested, Ginger Vieira .com, you have a list of a lot of articles that you've written on a myriad of subjects.
Yes.
And it really is worth a look through, because looking through, there'll be lots of ones that you'll be thinking, oh, that sounds interesting. And it'll lead you down a rabbit hole. You'll end up you know, be reading till midnight. but as I say, really, I love the writing style because complicated topics are broken down into bits and you read them and you think, oh, yeah, no, I get that. I get that. And at the end you think,
yeah,
oh, why has nobody explained it to me like that before?
Good. I'm glad.
Yeah, no. So I'd recommend that and have a look at some of the books because they are, again, really interesting and understandable, which is what we need, and practical. So thanks ever such a lot. And as Tom says, hopefully we'll get you back on at some point.
All right, just let me know.
More. Yeah, that would yeah. be great. So thank you so much for your time, though, Ginger.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you so much.
Yeah, take care.
Bye, guys.
Bye.